Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
Did you know that nearly all parts of the human body can be traced back to fish? Oh, I know you mightn't like this. I'm not sure that I'm welcoming it myself when I think about it, but they can all be traced back to fish, and particularly to fish 380 million years ago. In the Devonian period, it was a while back, I agree. This period formed the basic body plan that led to the human. Now, evolution made some big innovations early on to create whole new anatomical systems, and how Devonian fish acquired these evolutionary novelties that became the human body plan is the focus of our chat on Nightlife this evening. My guest is Professor John Long, who's a strategic professor in paleontology at Flinders University. John's been passionate about fossils and the stories they tell us since he was a kid, exploring creek beds and beaches with his cousin, Tim Flannery. How about that? It's a passion that's become a career, and it's taken them around the globe, from the depths of Antarctica to the rugged crags of northern Scotland. But his particular specialty is fish, especially those from the Devonian period, and his research around the genesis of our body parts in Devonian fish has been widely published, including his groundbreaking discovery of the origins of sex in a type of fish which rewrote evolutionary history. In other words, Professor John Long knows who done it, where, and to whom. I don't know whether he knows why, but he's on the program to explain. John, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. Pleasure to be here.
The common view, I suppose, I mean, the common view, that if we think about these things at all, is that when we, on the road to becoming Homo sapiens, which was only, what, maybe 250 or 300,000 years ago,
yeah,
on the road to becoming us, modern humans, we were originally in the oceans. And the common view is that we somehow managed to climb out of the ocean, fin first, I suspect, flapping and wobbling, and figured out, yeah, maybe we could have, you know, a camp on the beach or a life here. And that's how land-based systems began. So real life, as it were, vertebrate life, began in the sea. Is that still the view?
Yes, absolutely. And it was this transition, moving from an animal in water, like a fish that's buoyed up, you know, by the water. It doesn't have to worry about gravity too much. Mm-hmm. But moving out of the sea and onto land, you have to change all these systems in the body. You have to suddenly support your weight with strong limbs. You have to change from using gills in the water to breathing air through lungs. You have to change your sensory systems to see in air instead of water and hear. So it was all these changes that fish underwent for that first step onto land that basically, what I'm arguing, is built the human body plan all that time, you know, 380 million years ago.
Yeah, so when we say the Devonian period, Devonian yep. fish, I mean, this trips off my tongue as though I know what I'm talking about, which I don't. Why is it called the Devonian period?
It was named after some rocks in Devon, but it's a period of the Earth's history that's about 70 million years long, which is quite a long time. It's like if you go from now back to when the dinosaurs were still alive, that's within the last 70 million years. But that's just one period of geological time. The Earth itself is 4.5 billion years old. So figure it out, 70 million years is still a sizable chunk of time any way you want to look at it. So a lot happened during that period.
So what's going on in the Devonian period? There are fish in the sea, obviously.
Oh, God, everything happened in the Devonian. We had life invading, not just fish leaving the sea, invading land, which happened much later in the Devonian, but the first plants, which had appeared just before the Devonian, started to really take off and develop from simple mosses at the beginning of the Devonian to gigantic forests of trees by the end of the Devonian. So that changed the whole atmosphere of the world, just the invasion of plants during the Devonian.
So this is millions of years before dinosaurs.
That's right, about at least a couple of hundred million years before the dinosaurs appeared on Earth. So the Devonian, to me, is the quintessential period when everything happened that kind of set up everything for the modern world that we live in today.
Hmm.
So the plants took over the land and in a very large way. Fish left the water and invaded land and became the first land animals. And things like the origins of sex, reproduction using sexual intimate forms of copulation evolved at the same time as well.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a moment.
Yep, yeah, we will.
So at this time, there's the oceans, of course, which cover way more of the Earth than currently, presumably, do they?
Yes, they do. They're much the same as today. Sure, the continents have different configurations. There were, you know, Gondwana, a giant supercontinent in the south, and Laurasia in the north, and other sort of land masses. But more or less the same proportion of sea to land was the same back then as it is today.
Mm-hmm. But on the land, there are no living creatures. We know this because of the fossil record. Is that right?
Well, we know there were plants and there were very small, tiny bug-like creatures, you know, because they've been around since just before the Devonian.
Right.
But there wasn't much else. There were no, like, backboned animals like amphibians or reptiles. That they came, you know, amphibians came towards the end of the Devonian. And small insects and things like that started to invade the land as plants took over and got bigger. Then, of course, there was a rapid evolution of invertebrate animals like silverfish and small insects and spider-like creatures, scorpions. There were some very big scorpions running around. Mm. And these are the kind of creatures that inhabited the land that we think enticed fish to invade land because there was a ready source of prey there that nothing was eating.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you think fish, bug-eyed as they were, came up to the surface of the water, thought, hello, hello, hello. There's a lot of things on the surface of the water. I wonder if I got out of here and went looking, what else I might find.
Well, that's exactly right. It wasn't my idea. It was an idea from scientists in America, and they call it the Buena Vista hypothesis, the good view hypothesis. if you look at vision in fishes in the water compared to tetrapods, animals like us on land, we have a much greater visual acuity through air than you do in water. And so you look at the skulls of these ancient fish and the eyes get bigger and bigger as they approach that step towards going onto land. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a bit of evidence backing it up as well. It wasn't just a crazy idea.
So these fish have skeletons, do they?
Indeed, they have the same skeleton as you have, with virtually the equivalent of all the same bones, but also modified slightly differently. Right. I mean, let me give you an example. If you look at a fish, they have two paired fins at the front called the pectoral fins, like the big triangular fins on a shark. They have a two paired fins at the back called pelvic fins, and they're the equivalent to our arms and our legs. The same sets of bones would evolve in fish in those same fins that carry on through to humans today. Even the humerus ulna and radius that you have in your arm and the femur, tibia, fibula in your leg, we find those in Devonian fish in the same fins.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
So, okay, so the fish somehow get themselves out. Oh, well, you know, we've heard the phrase a fish out of water. Fish don't do very well out of water normally.
Well, some of them do. they can, like mudskippers in northern Queensland and Western Australia can live out of water up trees and, you know, they can, and lungfishes can live out of water in burrows where they make a sort of mud burrow around themselves to survive wet, dry seasons until the next rains come. Mm-hmm. Not the Queensland lungfish, but I'm talking about the ones in Africa and South America.
So during the Devonian period, were these fish very, very big or were they little?
We had fish in the Devonian up to probably 6 or 7 meters in length.
Wow.
Very, very large armoured fish called placoderms. And placoderms are important to know because they're a whole extinct group of animals that most people have never heard of, but they rule the Earth for something like 70 million years as the dominant life, backbone life on the planet. And I've made a life career in studying placoderms, and we have the best preserved placoderms in the world from right here in Australia, which is no coincidence why they're interesting to study, because they're not just skeletons, but we have sometimes the soft tissue preserved of their muscles or their internal organs, and sometimes even the remains of other things like their embryos inside them.
Mm. Okay, so tell me about jaws and teeth and skulls.
We come back to placoderms. Yeah. And so I'm going to give your readers a visual painting of what a placoderm is.
Yeah.
Imagine a shark with a long shark-like tail, but the head of the shark and the front of the body is covered in armoured plates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the German word is Panzerfisch, which, you know, means like armoured fish.
I love that.
It's like a tank, basically. So you've got these bony armoured plates forming a Darth Vader-like helmet over the over the head.
Yeah.
These big, huge jaws, which have like sharp pointed bits that don't really look like teeth. And for many years, scientists argued that these weren't teeth. They were just bones with sharp bits on them kind of thing. But it's only in recent years we've studied them using X-ray synchrotrons and looking at their detailed histology. And we know that these were true teeth. They had the same tissues of dentine and pulp cavities and things that define teeth today. So they really were the first creatures on the planet to have jaws and teeth and to diversify and grow into very large sizes. So that's why placoderms are kind of important to the story.
So what you're saying is that these jaws and these teeth are what led to our jaws and teeth today. So we can draw a line all the way to us.
Exactly. Well, it was a mystery and debated for a long time, but some spectacular discoveries coming out of China by some of my colleagues I know very well, Professor Zhu Min in Beijing. They actually showed the oldest placoderms in the world, announced to the world only in October last year. And these included very early forms with really beautifully developed jaws and teeth and so on. But the point is, it's from this point of origin in placoderms that you then evolve into the what we call the bony fishes, which really become the ancestors of the line leading to amphibians, reptiles and mammals, or us. So that's why we need to understand placoderms as the beginning of the story, that many things appear first in placoderms, like arms or paired fins at the front, and then they carry through right to us.
Hmm. We don't know about the earliest interest in football, but, I mean, that's another matter. I'm sure we'll get there.
Yep.
Tell me about limbs, though. I love this. I love the idea.
Yep.
I love the idea that the front pectoral fins are our arms and the pelvic fins are our legs. Because in a sense, with fish that can live on the land, as you say, that's pretty much how it works, isn't it?
Well, it is. And if we look at the more advanced fish, of which we call the lobe fin fish, Sarcopterygians is the technical term.
Mm.
This includes things like the coelacanth, which is a archaic form thought to have been extinct with the dinosaurs that was found alive in the 1930s, living off Africa. And the lungfish, which we have in Queensland, the Queensland lungfish. Now, these are very advanced bony fish that have paired fins, limbs at the front, which are the equivalent to our arms, and the pelvic fins at the back, equivalent to our legs.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you get to extinct forms of these groups that go a bit further than what we see in a living coelacanth, we get the intermediate forms between, say, a coelacanth and a frog. We get forms that have the bony fins so well developed that we do have these three bones, the humerus, ulna, radius, forming their pectoral fin. But in some of them, we discovered they have the beginnings of the hand bones, the carpal bones, and even digits.
Really?
Digit bones in the fin.
So fingers are first appearing in these
divining fins. Yes, fingers. That's right. I wouldn't call them technically a finger, because a finger is something that extends out of a hand and can move independently of each other.
Mm.
Instead, we have rows of digits that are the archaic bones that form the fingers, but they're locked within a fin. So they're not like separate fingers as like a glove. They're more like a mitten, if you like, around the, locked into the pectoral fin. But we discovered this only in 2020. We published it in Nature based on a superb, gigantic fish fossil found in Canada that I was invited to go and study with my good friend Richard Cloutier, who's just arrived and he's in Australia for the next few months to work with me at Flinders University doing more studies on the same fish.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered through using synchrotron, giant powerful accelerator machines that can image fossils while they're still in the rock, that this fish had the rows of digits that formed on the end of its fin exactly like the fingers we get in the hand of humans.
Okay. What about toes? I mean, did the pectoral fins... Hang on, the pectoral fins are much smaller than the... the pelvic fins are much smaller than the pectoral fins, so...
Well, no,
are they or not?
They're small in some fish. They're equally large in others.
Oh,
but
okay.
The thing is that we do have the pelvic fins of this amazing fish called Opisthostege, and we've just got the synchrotron data back. But unfortunately, it's top secret at the moment until we publish it. So we'll be probably publishing that later this year and revealing what's happening there. But more or less, they would expect it to be following the same kind of pattern that we get in the arms as in the legs.
So toes as well are also part of... Do we know, here's a question, do we know where these first fish came ashore?
That's a very good question. It's something else I've been studying with a group of colleagues from overseas, from Uppsala University, actually. We had an expedition in 2016 to the west coast of Ireland. Now, those of you that have seen the Star Wars movies, the recent ones, you see the Skelligs of St. Michael off the coast of Valencia Island in County Cork.
Yeah.
And it's along Valencia Island there that we actually found tetrapod footprints of land animals walking on land. We know it's definitely land and not underwater because we have raindrop impressions on those layers. And it shows that these Devonian tetrapods were walking on land about 385 million years ago, even before some of the fossil evidence shows we have the remains of the creatures that might have formed those trackways. But it's very exciting stuff. I mean, the trackways have been known there for a long time, but we went back, we discovered a bunch of new trackways by walking around the entire island, and we've scanned them using LIDAR to get digital data of what those trackways look like. And we're in the process of working on a paper on that at the moment as well.
Okay, so look, that doesn't mean that it was Ireland where they first came ashore, but that's the evidence we have at the moment.
Yeah, that's the earliest. We have some other trackways in Poland that are a couple of million years earlier, but these are much clearer and better defined, the ones from Ireland. So we've got trackways in Australia as well.
I was going to say, what about in our very ancient big brown land?
We do. We've got the inner Devonian period. We've got some outcrops of beautiful rock from the Devonian around Cooper Canberra National Park in the far east of Victoria, near the New South Wales border, the Genoa River area. And trackways were first discovered there back in the 1970s. And they were thought to be the oldest tetrapods or land animals in the world at the time. We went back there in 2017. We had to hire a helicopter to get in because it was so remote. And we walked and walked and walked, and we didn't find any more trackways, but we did find a lot of other fossil evidence there to reconstruct the environment of these tetrapod trackways. And we've done a study of the original trackways, which are in Museum Victoria, to show these creatures actually had six fingers and toes, and the toes were sticking out the side, not to the front. So we have two things to think about here, Phil. One is when fish first left the water and they had very simple arms and legs with digits, the digits were facing away from the animal. And then later, when they became fully terrestrial, able to walk on land with confidence, the wrist developed and they were able to turn their hands inwards and have fingers and toes that faced the front.
Here's a question. Yeah. Why do we seem to have developed five fingers, or you say six, but in that region and not, for example, 15 or 20? You'd think that might be even more useful. You could certainly play the piano a lot easier, couldn't you?
Well, that's a brilliant question, and it comes back to how many fingers did these first tetrapods actually have? Mm. If we look at specimens from East Greenland from the late Devonian, they showed they had between 7 and 8 fingers and toes on their hands. Others had 6, both from Australia and also the ones found in Russia. And so there was a hugely variable number of fingers and toes with the first tetrapods, and it wasn't until they became fully terrestrial with the fingers facing the front that we get this standard pattern of five fingers and toes, this asymmetry of the hands that means you're walking forwards with your fingers and toes pointing in the direction you're heading. So we associate five fingers and toes, or the pentadactyl hand and foot, with fully terrestrial ability to walk on land.
Hmm. So at some point there seemed to be some evolutionary advantage in having that many and not more, presumably.
Exactly. Hmm. It's kind of like you can get onto land with basic fins, but you can't do much with it. Yeah. But when you're fully terrestrial, then you're running and living on land, then you've got the right tools to do the job.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We're talking about Devonian fish and humans. We're going to talk in a minute about the origins of sex too, because amazingly, Professor John Long, my guest, thinks he can pinpoint when it all happened. We're going on an evolutionary journey through our body parts tonight. So, well, my guest is Professor John Long, a strategic professor in paleontology at Flinders University. He's the author of 25 or so books, including the legendary, and you'll love this title, Hung Like an Argentine Duck, Tracing the Origins of Sexual Reproduction from Fishes Right Through to Humans. We've been talking about how fish came ashore in the Devonian period some 380 million years ago, and how, astonishingly, even that far back, we developed fingers and toes off the fins of these fish, and We've just been discussing why there are five. There. So do we know what the evolutionary advantage was for five and not more, John?
Yes, yes. As I was just saying, Phil, it's adaptation to full terrestrial ability to walk on land properly, not just sort of flap around with your fins facing outwards. So by turning your hands in and having a wrist, you've got arms and legs that can pull you forwards more efficiently, and that's when the five-fingered hand kind of evolved.
Yeah. If you've got questions, by the way, about evolution and where we came from, you might be surprised to learn that we were all once fish in the ocean. You say we've found, or you have found, the oldest evidence of sex on the planet too, which rewrote evolutionary history. Tell us about discovering the origins of sex up in the Kimberley.
Well, it goes back for me, Phil, about 37 or 38 years ago. I first became involved in studying fossils from Gogo Station up in the Kimberley near Fitzroy Crossing. Mm-hmm. And this is a beautiful site. It's quite unique in the whole world because the Devonian fish here that are about 380 million years old are three-dimensionally perfectly preserved. They're uncrushed. They occur in limestone concretions, which we put in weak baths of acetic acid. Dissolves the rock but not the bone, so the bone comes out in perfect three-dimensional form, just like they died yesterday.
Okay, but
we've also learned that now, using powerful new tools like synchrotrons and neutron beams, we can image them while they're still inside the rock and find all sorts of soft tissues. So my colleagues and I, including Kate Trinajstic from Curtin University, who led a recent study, found the oldest heart of any a vertebrate animal inside one of these go-go fish, complete with the chambers.
You
the
found a really?
Yes. We published this in Science only a few months ago.
But hang on, surely all those soft tissues are long gone. How can you?
No, they were rapidly mineralized in the process of instant fossilization in this unique fossil environment. Not only that, we also discovered the liver, the intestine, parts of the stomach. We've got muscles completely preserved in some of these fish. So it really is one of the world's best and greatest fossil sites. It really should be a World Heritage Site. If, dare I say, only politics didn't get in the way, it would be right up there. But that aside, we're getting back to the question of how we discovered the origin of sex. Well, the origin of sexual reproduction goes much further back in the fossil record, but we're talking about single cells and things back then. What I'm talking about is the origin of internal fertilization.
Exactly. We're talking about getting it on here, John. I mean,
exactly. Intimate sexual relationships between a male and a female.
Exactly. Fancy meeting you here in a place like this, you know. Exactly.
That's right.
Your place or mine. That's what we're talking about.
It could even be the origins of love. Mm. I mean, it's courtship and the male's actually becoming intimate with the female and impregnating her with sperm. So how did that first start? I mean, if you look at sharks, which are a good analogy, the males have claspers or long trailing organs on the pelvic fins and the females don't. And that's because the males insert those claspers inside the female and deposit sperm. And that's called internal fertilization. It's the opposite to what trout do when the females lay a bunch of eggs at the bottom of the river and the males, you know, put sperm on top of them, which is called external fertilization, where your eggs grow up and nobody cares because they're just all this, you know, some of them might make it and some of them won't. But with internal fertilization, it means the females are having a completely different strategy in evolution. Instead of laying tens of thousands of eggs, they're investing everything into a very small number, might be 3, 4, 5, or 6. But they're putting more energy into developing those inside the body of the female so they're more competent when they're born, that they can come out and be fully functional and have a better chance of survival. So how did we discover that this was happening in Devonian fish? Well, you might think that we found the sexual organs on the fish, but if we did, that only indicates they may or may not have been using them in the, you know, the very intimate way. Instead, we discovered one of these go-go fish that had an unborn embryo inside the mother.
You're kidding.
And not only the small miniature skeleton of the unborn embryo, but it was connected by a fossilized umbilical cord.
No.
And we identified
this.
Yes.
I'm astonished. Absolutely. I'm astonished that you could discover these things.
We did. Using a synchrotron and using all sorts of high-powered CT scanning, we're able to identify the structures, and you could see it in 3D. It's perfect. And you can see it even in the fossil once we prepared it. So you can see it with your own eyes. So when we discovered this fish, it was a new type. So we got to name it, and I chose the name Martyrpisces, meaning mother fish, Attenborough eye after Sir David Attenborough, who, when I met up with him later, was really thrilled and pleased to have this fish named after him. But he joked that now his name will always be associated with the origin of sex. Yeah. So he kind of
It's no bad thing, I think, John. If you want to be associated with the origin of something, I think it's no bad thing. You could have a quiet pride.
It isn't a bad thing, and he was very happy to see me and hear that story. But the interesting thing is, then we were looking for the smoking gun. We needed to find the sexual organs on the fish that were actually doing it. So we went back to the collections and we had a look through the entire collection of GoGo fossils in the Australian collections, and our friend Zarina Johansson in the British Museum found a specimen there that had other embryos, but we still couldn't find sexual organs of this particular type of fish. But then eventually we found one, and literally it was right under my nose. It was a specimen that one of my students had prepared to study for a master's thesis, and it had the clasper as a bony organ, not a soft, rubbery cartilage organ that we get in sharks, but it was basically the same kind of structure. And so we then identified that not only did they have internal fertilization, but how they were doing it, these large bony organs. But you know what? The most interesting thing about it all was that if you look at sharks, that clasper organ comes off the pelvic fins as a lobe on the pelvic fin. But Kate Trinajstic, whom I work with closely in Curtin University, did a review of all these claspers once we'd got our eye in and we could find them. And we identified that they were separate from the pelvic fin. In fact, they were developed as a separate set of limbs. So you've got your pectoral fins or arms at the front, your pelvic fins or legs paired at the back, and then behind them in placoderms, we had an extra set of bony structures, which were actually the reproductive organs, but they weren't connected to those pelvic fins, so they were independently developed.
Right, okay. All right, 1-300-800-222. Professor John Long is with us. We're talking about evolution and how we came out of the primeval goop or ocean or... Hi, Dave. G'day, Dave.
G'day. Is that me, Dave?
Yeah, Dave, you're on.
How are you going?
Well,
I was actually listening in for the quiz, but this is a really interesting topic.
Yeah.
I don't want to go too far off the tangent here. Mm. I work in the mining industry, and as we cut the wall down, apparently I'm seeing 300 million years of evolution. All this stuff that the professor's talking about, I think, is absolutely, 100% true. But, I mean, looking at this history as we go down the wall and then thinking about today's, and I don't want to get into too much of the political green thing or anything, but if all this stuff existed 300 million years ago in order to create coal and all that sort of stuff, in 300 million years from now, they might pick me up and say, well, Dave's got a good calorific content for burning. I mean, how can we, and I don't want to get too, hang up on me if you like, but how can we go into this whole green thing if we already understand that all this stuff existed 300-400 million years ago, the iron ore 3-4 billion years ago was developed? Then how can we have this conversation about climate change? And that might be getting off topic.
No. It's a good question, actually. Things like coal have been formed because we've had massive forests that, trees fell into swamps and eventually got compressed and, formed coal. And oil is from the dead organisms that lived at the bottom of the sea and eventually got buried, and their organic components, their hydrocarbons got concentrated and eventually formed, oil deposits. So that's all part of the natural cycle of life. The problem is that beyond the natural cycle of life, where humans are just burning so many carbon fuels that we're upping the ante of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at a far faster rate than it would have happened in nature.
Naturally.
We know, for example, back in the dinosaur age that greenhouse gases were many times higher than they were on the Earth today. So you might think, well, what's the problem? Well, the problem was it took tens of millions of years for that to build up, and the world was adjusting to it as it went. The problem with today is that the amount of greenhouse gases are rising the temperatures at a far faster rate than has ever happened in geological history, and that's why we're in a problem today.
That's why we're in trouble.
So I'm keeping politics out of it because this is not political.
It's a matter of science, isn't it?
Yeah. Pure science, yeah.
Can I just ask another question? Is that okay?
Yeah, go on, Dave.
And so when I look at the wall in the coal mine, for example, and it goes down to where the coal is, Now, I see the layers of sedimentary, whatever has happened. Some of those events, they might be an inch or two deep. That might have been, as far as I can tell, over 300 million years, that might have been a 1,000-year flood.
There were lots of events. Actually, if we look at the coal deposits in the great basins of America, in Illinois and also in the Midlands of England, you find cyclothems, which are repeated cycles of coal swamps followed by sea level rises and marine deposits on top of them. And each one of those cycles is called a cyclothem. There are roughly 50 of those through the Carboniferous period in England and the USA. And I've just been writing about these actually in a book that I'm working on at the moment about, it's called About the Evolution of Sharks. But the best shark fossils come from these layers above the coal deposits all through that central Illinois basin. And it's because of these cycles of sea level rises and falls causing freshwater deposits with coal, followed by marine deposits with sharks and marine fossils, repeating themselves again and again and again. So it's all got to do with the natural cycle of sea level rising and falling with, you know, the way climate has naturally been changing during those periods of the Earth's history.
Mm. Thanks, Dave. Good on you. 1-300-800-222. I mean, you can see what Dave's talking about. If you're cutting down through walls of rock, you're seeing the life of the planet, aren't you, in a way?
Absolutely.
Yep. Scott from Mount Martha. G'day, Scott.
Yeah, good evening.
Hi.
Really fascinating discussion, thank you. It's really been quite enlightening. I had a curiosity or an association, I guess, I made based on this evolutionary pathway from fish to, I guess, modern Homo sapiens eventually. I'm fascinated by the fact that human embryos in utero are able to extract oxygen from a liquid in the womb, essentially. And it's only when you're actually born that you sort of, move into this kind of this root shock into the world and start breathing air directly through your lungs. But is that a throwback to that same fish ancestry that we're able to actually extract oxygen from a liquid in utero?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right there, Scott, because if you look at the hard-shelled egg, which all reptiles have, then all creatures basically are born into an aqueous liquid environment. And as their lungs develop, it's not until they break out of that they actually start breathing air. But if we look at what are the transitional forms of life today that sort of explain that, we can go to things like lungfishes, which the Queensland lungfish can breathe air with its lungs when it needs to, but otherwise it uses its gills and happily lives in the rivers, for most of its time. And even slightly more advanced lungfish from Africa and South America can actually breathe air for long periods of time, and they would drown if you kept them in water, kind of thing, because they don't have enough gills to completely sustain an aquatic kind of lifestyle. So we see all sorts of intermediate conditions in living fishes today that show that you can do both, quite successfully. And a human embryo goes through a phase where it has gill slits, just like a fish, and then we lose that and evolve into a, more mammalian kind of body form.
Hmm.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? This is the wonderful thing about the story of evolution, isn't it? That when you look in detail, as you've been doing, and scientists like you do, you discover all along the pathway through this evolutionary process, there are all, as you say, there are all these stages. It didn't just suddenly happen. It happened gradually, didn't it?
Yeah, of course, because time is evolution's friend.
Yeah.
It takes a long time for change to happen.
Stuart from Canberra. Hi, Stuart.
Oh, g'day. How's it going?
Very well.
Great. The question I had was, this is a fascinating discussion, by the way. Excellent late-night chats. I'm just trying to remember back to first year uni, and I think flowering plants were sort of around the, correct me if I'm wrong, like 140, 150-ish million years ago. So if these these Devonian creatures were walking the earth at 350 million years ago, what were they eating?
Ah, bugs. plants, as I said, we had large forests established by the end of the Devonian with lycopod trees and giant ferns that were like 20 meters tall. But the land animals living at the time before the tetrapods or amphibians came onto land would have been things like spiders and scorpions, silverfish, small kinds of ground insects, mites and ticks and things like that, whatever. But a whole lot of invertebrates were there. And we had, for example, in the period straight after the Devonian, we have gigantic millipedes up to 2.5 meters in length called Arthropleura. And we have trackways occurring with tetrapods in Ireland that indicate there were very large scorpions running around on land at the time as well. So there would have been plenty of those sorts of food objects for the fish and the early tetrapods to chase after.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
Okay, Stuart, thank you. Paul from South Perth. G'day, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm another one who's harking back to my long past university days.
And, yeah.
I'm just got a question about the evolution of gill arches from fish to terrestrial vertebrates.
Yeah.
And how a lot of the gill arches were actually repurposed into other morphological structures.
Yeah, like jaws. Oh,
yeah.
Like ear bones, inner ear bones.
Yeah, yeah, basically. Can you, like,
Yeah, I'll happily expound on that if you want.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to.
I mean, we've got, you take your primitive basic fish and you've got like 5 or 6 sets of gill arches, but the forward ones were thought in jawless fish, like lampreys, or ancestors of jawless fish, to have evolved into the 2 narrow bones at the front that became jaws. So the upper and lower jaws were believed to have evolved from the very front gill arches. But the ones behind them immediately, called the hyoid arch, we see them clearly in living fishes. So we know there's a series of bones behind the jaws and go underneath the jaws, called the caratohyle. But we know that in the transition to land, these bones became smaller and smaller in these fish, lobe-fin fish with powerful arms and legs, till eventually the hyoid, the bone called the higher mandibula, becomes what's called the stapes, or the inner ear bone that we hear through. And the incus, malleus, and stapes are the 3 bones that form the human inner, the eardrum and the inner ear sort of system. They're all derived from those bones that were part of the back of the jaws and supporting the jaws to the brain case in these ancient fish. And you can see a clear transition of those bones getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And there's still remnants of them in reptiles at the back of the jaws. And then eventually when you become a mammal, those bones are all locked into the ear and they're no longer connected to the jaws. So it's a beautifully evolution transition to see how those bones have gone from fish to mammals and still trace them right through.
Hmm. We're talking about the origins of sex. Well, more importantly, I suppose, how we came out of the oceans as fish and became terrestrial creatures with Professor John Long, who's a professor in paleontology. And what they can discover these days about fossils, I find quite awe-inspiring, quite frankly, because you might have thought fossils were just fossilized bones, but this is just not so, as Professor Long's been telling us. They've discovered hearts and livers and umbilical cords as well. You've also worked in Antarctica.
Yes.
John, what's it like finding fossils in Antarctica?
It's very hard work, actually.
I can imagine.
It's cold and it's hard, and you have 24 hours of daylight, so you have big, long days. And where we were working back in the biggest expedition I had was back in 91, 92. I was on a New Zealand expedition collecting in an unknown part of the Transantarctic Mountains where we were airlifted so far from the base. We were taken by a Hercules aircraft, dumped out on the back of a glacier, and then we sledged about 700 kilometres through largely unknown, unexplored areas, making base camps and exploring the rocks, mapping the geology, finding fossils. And it was one of the greatest adventures of my entire life. I ended up writing a book about it, actually, about the whole journey, called A Journey Through the Mountains of Madness. The funny thing was that I was given a book by my colleagues, a gothic horror story by H.P. Lovecraft called At the Mountains of Madness, 1931, about a paleontological expedition that goes searching for fossils and they discover an alien civilization. They all either get eaten or go mad. And as we were reading pages from this book aloud each night, we realized we were going to the imaginary latitude and longitude in that book that was called the Mountains of Madness. So we nicknamed the mountains there the Mountains of Madness, and we had a great time exploring the geology and finding lots of fossils in those mountains.
Mm. Interesting, fascinating. Steve on the Hume. G'day, Steve.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm not a religious person in any way, but I want to know, If we evolved from fishes, how come the fishes aren't still evolving now, and why aren't the humans walking out of the ocean now?
Because
that's a good question.
At any one time in evolution, you've got hundreds of different lines of evolution going on. I mean, jellyfish have been around for over a billion years, but they're still here today. That doesn't mean they're not evolving. They've evolved a hell of a lot from those primitive jellyfish, the same as insects, the same as plants. But at any time in the evolution of life, you get forms that are happy and are very doing well in their environment. They don't change much. They have slow rates of evolution. You get other things that are under pressure or chaos to survive, and they either go extinct or they change rapidly. So for any time of the Earth's history, you have a mixture of primitive and advanced kind of life forms. Some are stragglers that are holding on from an archaic time. Others are newly evolved forms that are changing into different life forms. And that's just the way it is with any kind of life on the planet.
Mm.
So, unless them fishes don't exist anymore, people should still be evolving from the ocean.
No, those fishes don't exist anymore. You're absolutely correct. They're called stem tetrapods, and they went extinct at the end of the Devonian. But that's because they evolved into land animals. So it's only a semantic term whether we call them fishes or land animals. They're the same lineage of creature.
Mm.
But we draw the line once they're walking on land with fingers and toes, we call them amphibians. But in reality, they're the same line of fish that's just continuing through.
Could that be why so many humans like being on the beach and going to the ocean and like being around water?
Well, I certainly love hanging around the beach and swimming in the ocean, but... Yeah, I like to put it back to my stem tetrapod days.
Steve, you got a hankering. You got a hankering to get back in there.
I'm actually a bush person. I like the bush. I don't like the beach. But yeah, maybe I wasn't a fish. Maybe I was a cow or something.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Maybe. Interesting. That's a fun question. But that's an interesting point, though, isn't it? So it's not as though there was an inevitability about the fact that all fish needed to get out on land. They didn't. But some fish, for some evolutionary purpose, which we're probably not sure of and maybe never answer, decided that their best future lay on the land.
Well, we have to think of the world as being very diverse with different habitats, different environments, different climates, just like it is today. And some parts are under more pressure to survive, and so there was greater rates of evolution happening. Like today in the tropical jungles and rainforests, we have great diversity of plants and birds and insects because there's more pressure to survive and there's more innovation in adapting to the different situations. Whereas other parts, the Arctic or the Antarctic seas, there's very slow rates of evolution and things there are fairly archaic and hanging on from a long way back.
Yeah, look, about the you're writing a book on sharks. Are you going to have a chapter on the Greenland shark? I'm fascinated by this creature. It lives for 400 years.
The book won't be out till next year. It's a complete history of sharks for average people. It's a layperson's kind of fun book. But yeah, the Greenland shark, we know they live for up to 500 years. So
how can they live that long? Do we understand why?
Slow rates of growth.
Right.
Yeah, slow growth rates. They sexually mature at a very late age. I mean, we've only learnt recently, for example, that white sharks, the great white shark, they become sexually mature between 23 and 31 years. 23 for the male, 31 for the female.
Oh, okay.
So they take a hell of a long time before they're even able to reproduce, which is why if you wipe out some of these sharks, you cull them, it can take hundreds of years to get those populations back.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm always fascinated. We did a program on dinosaurs once, and I love the fact that a lot of people believe. I don't know whether this is most scientists believe this now that modern day birds have a direct lineage to dinosaurs and that...
Modern-day birds are dinosaurs.
They are dinosaurs. They didn't evolve
from
dinosaurs.
Nobody doubts that anymore.
Yeah, that they are dinosaurs. In other words, we think a lot of these creatures disappeared, but they didn't.
They didn't, exactly right. I mean, we've got... In the old days, we had one fossil called Archaeopteryx, which was found in Germany, which was a reptilian kind of primitive bird. It had arms with feathers on it, but it had a long reptilian tail and had teeth in its mouth like a reptile.
Hmm.
Now we've got dozens of intermediate forms coming out of China that show every intermediate stage between a small running dinosaur with feathers, small feathers, and then others with slightly bigger arms and bigger feathers, and then they lose the tail and then they become birds. So the whole transition from small running dinosaurs to flying birds is beautifully documented by a fantastic series of fossils showing every transitional stage.
Wow. So presumably in the oceans there are fish, therefore, that also date from this period, are there?
From the Devonian?
Yeah.
Well, we've got things like lampreys, jawless fish. The earliest lampreys go back to the Devonian. We have sharks. Now
they're very old sharks,
aren't they? As a group, we can say sharks go back 460 million years as a group.
Wow.
But the oldest living sharks, we're the same like genus of shark, like, you know, we're Homo, genus Homo, humans, and Canis is the genus dog, for example. So you take the Port Jackson shark that's called Heterodontus, you know, a common little shark. You find him on most beaches around seas around Australia. That genus goes right back to the Jurassic period. So the oldest member of that living genus is like 150 million years old. So many of our sharks that are living today, grey nurse sharks are another one, Carcharias, they go right back over 100 million years. And then that genus has still gone right through to the present day. So indeed, many sharks that we see today are living fossils that haven't changed much at all.
Mm. Because this is what is fascinating about evolution, isn't it? Because everyone assumes that everything's evolving all the time, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, of course not, because every environment's different.
Yeah.
Some environments are changing and under pressure. And the big steps in evolution happened after the big mass extinction events.
That's right.
So when we had the asteroid that slammed into the Earth 66 million years ago and kind of wiped out all the big dinosaurs on Earth, it was the little ones, the little feathered dinosaurs, the birds that got through, and the small mammals, the small lizards and reptiles, they all got through that event and reinvented themselves. And, you know, hence we've got mammals here today that have taken over the planet, and lots of birds as well. So every time there was the five large mass extinction events in the last 500 million years, and after every single one of those events, life had to basically adapt to chaos and change. Mm. So we get bursts of evolution happening straight after them.
Can you answer this one really quickly? Noel says, I was always told we evolved from the apes, Phil. What happened here?
Well, we did evolve from apes, but where did the apes evolve from? Yeah. They evolved from more primitive mammals. And where did those mammals come from? They evolved from reptiles. Where do those reptiles come from? They evolved from amphibians. And those amphibians evolved from fish. So I'm talking about an unbroken lineage from fish to humans. And sure, apes are certainly part of that story, but they're right at the very end.
Yeah, this is the thing. And when you talk about, we talk about 380 million years ago, Homo sapiens has only walked this earth for about 250,000 years. It's nothing, is it? It's absolutely nothing. And we're rapidly in the business of destroying ourselves. So we may rank as one of the shortest living human structures on earth unless we're careful. It's been fascinating, John. I could talk for hours about this, and I know others could as well, but I do thank you for your time. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure, Phil. It's been absolutely a lot of fun, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Professor John Long is a strategic professor in paleontology at Flinders University. It would be a fascinating job, wouldn't it? And the stuff you can discover and the stuff you get to work on and the places you get to visit as well. Thanks for the texts and calls. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.